Hello and welcome to the Many Rules of Film Club. This is Jeff Yance. I'm the program director at the Loft Cinema, joined today by Heather Lottis, occasional filmmaker.
Hola.
And Rusty Boulay Stevenson, multimedia artist.
Never nominated for an Academy Award.
That will change soon, I'm pretty sure.
I know it will.
Yes. So today we're going to be talking about someone that I think it's safe to say is one of the most provocative and important filmmakers today. Spike Lee.
That's right.
Has been for the last 30 years and still going strong. So Spike Lee's career has really been sort of an interesting litmus case for the industry, the Hollywood industry, in terms of what gets represented on screen. And he's always been there pushing buttons and pushing the envelope in a really great way. So I think we're going to start at the beginning.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Spike Lee is always a good place to start with his first feature film, 1986, She's Gotta Have It, which I love.
Yeah.
His first feature film came after his student film out of NYU. His student film from NYU actually won a Student Academy Award, which is a thing that I think a lot of people don't know about. And Spike Lee has been very, you know, vocal when he talks about his career, saying he thought that was going to launch him into studio filmmaking. Did not get him offers, and I think there are many reasons why, and he has articulated those reasons. The film that he wanted to do first was School Days, and he was trying to sell that to various studios. No one was having it, so he decided to make a smaller film that was, he said, going to give people what they wanted, which was lots of sex, which he did.
Right.
And he made She's Gotta Have It, which is not just about sex. It's about a lot of other things. But it is a very sexy film and a very sexual film set in Brooklyn, about a young woman named Nola Darling, who is this very confident artist. She's very liberated. She has a very healthy sex drive, unapologetic sex drive, no interest in commitment. So she's juggling a lot of different men, one of them being Spike Lee himself in the film, playing the character that he later went on to play in a lot of Nike commercials.
Yeah.
And I think the film is very funny. It's technically, I suppose, a romantic comedy, but it's also, because it's Spike Lee, it's got a real edge to it. And I think it was pretty radical at the time and even today, because it was cast entirely with African-American actors in Brooklyn, coming from, I guess, the blaxploitation genre of the 70s. This was one of the first films, independent films of the 80s, that actually talked about the black experience in a way that wasn't a genre film, wasn't exploitive, it wasn't about, you know...
Right.
Pam Grier, you know, fighting the man or anything. And it's an amazing film, great performances. It's very Spike Lee in the sense that it's almost fantastical. It doesn't feel like it's rooted in reality. It's a documentary narrative hybrid. He inserts a lot of shots of his Brooklyn neighborhood, photographs of his Brooklyn neighborhood, of the residents and the street life, and intercut with the actual narrative that's happening. And it's a very funny movie. And I think Spike Lee sometimes doesn't get credit for being a funny filmmaker.
True.
Because his movies are so often charged, politically charged and emotional. This movie is really funny. And he is hilarious in the film. If you've seen the film, you know, please, baby, please, baby, please, baby, please, please, please. Great. It's just a great performance. And just one other thing I wanted to say about this film is the sex in the film kind of became the focal point of a lot of the talk around the film, I think, when it came out. And it also got the film an X rating from the MPAA, which Spike Lee, who's, you know, never shy about theorizing about why things are
right.
the way they are, I think rightfully has said this film got an X rating from the MPAA because they don't know what to do with black sexuality. Female sexuality in general, but much less black female sexuality.
Yeah.
Yep.
So he had to trim it to get an R rating, and it's still, you know, pretty sensual and all that. But if you ever get a chance to see the unrated version, it's pretty great. I think Criterion put it out on Laserdisc, the unrated, which you can still
buy. Wow, that's great to know.
If you have a Laserdisc player and access to that format.
I do.
Which I do, too. That's what I just... I watched it on Laserdisc just recently,
nice.
The other night. Yeah.
Wow.
And you had to flip it?
I had to flip it. I have to flip it.
Sorry.
It's old school.
Do you have a beta player, too?
I actually do.
I don't have one of those.
Yes. I'm an old technology hoarder,
so
for sure. Yeah. So anyway, so that was a really auspicious beginning to his career, because this was a movie that actually made a lot of money. It's supposedly one of the most successful independent films of all time based on budget to gross.
Mm-hmm. So $175,000 budget is estimated. $175,000. It made over $7 million.
Yes. Yeah, and this was part of that movement in the mid-80s, this indie movement. Jim Jarmusch came out of this. This was right around the time the Coen brothers did their first movie, Blood Simple. And there was this burgeoning kind of interest in low-budget, independent filmmaking and different voices. And his was certainly a different voice at that time in a lot of different ways.
Sure, he and Jarmusch went to film school together.
Yeah, NYU.
At NYU.
Film
NYU.
School.
Yeah.
Yep.
And this film's indicative, I haven't seen it, but it's indicative of what would be Spike Lee's career in that he's the director, he's in it, right?
Yes.
He's also the writer, and he was the producer. He's the one that drummed up the money for it.
Yes.
He continues to produce his own films, that drumming up the money for it, and he a lot of times has to go to the community of African-American actors and directors and people on TV, celebrities, to get money to make his movies.
Yeah.
That happens a lot.
And he goes back and forth with the giant studio projects and these little independent films. And I think that also makes him interesting. And he has said that he wanted to make something like She's Gotta Have It because he wanted there to be an accurate representation of African-American life as he knew it. But you do not see in Hollywood films. And I think he's remained true to that throughout his career up until today.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things I loved, I watched Mo Better Blues for this podcast, and I just the thoughtfulness with which he deals with his African-American characters, you never see that in other Hollywood films. Too often they're stereotypes. There's a lovingness and a caringness of showing real life that Spike Lee is able to do that a lot of times Hollywood just glosses over and you get stereotypes.
Right.
And instead, his characters are really fully drawn and really thoughtful. Denzel Washington in Mo Better Blues is a really interesting character.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And shown with, even though he's a flawed character, he's shown with a lot of love and everything about it. He's depicted with so much love and intelligence. And it's really neat to see. It was certainly groundbreaking for me to see some of his films, Spike Lee's films, as I was growing up and watching Hollywood films compared to Spike Lee films.
Yeah, and he also loves New York. So
particularly
those early films, you know, set in Brooklyn and the Bronx and different boroughs. And he really captures, I think, the flavor in a way that you don't see in mainstream films, which are very kind of gentrified portrayals of those areas. So he's kind of showing how it actually is, which I think is great also.
Yeah. Yeah. So he did Do the Right Thing in 1989, which was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture.
Right.
It did not win. Instead, Driving Miss Daisy did.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting commentary on where Hollywood was at then and now.
And now. It hasn't changed that much.
Yeah. No. I think there was a certain kind of self-congratulatory vibe in Hollywood that they gave the Best Picture Oscar to a film about race, Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
When you compare that to Do the Right Thing, clearly there's a huge gap in terms of representation.
And just what it represents in film history, Do the Right Thing is going to be talked about 25 years from now. Driving Miss Daisy, does anybody watch that movie now?
No, we love Morgan Freeman, we love Jessica Tandy, but we don't really think about that film anymore.
As a great film.
No, I don't think so.
Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing is going to go down as a monumental, groundbreaking film.
It's one of the pivotal movies of American history, for sure. American film history. So Spike Lee has certainly not focused specifically on African-American issues, which also makes him an interesting filmmaker. So, Heather, one film that you were talking about really liking was 25th Hour.
Yeah, I watched 25th Hour, which I had not watched since it first came out. It came out 2001, 2002?
Two, yeah.
And it was just when he initially started working with that project, it was before 9/11. And then they incorporated the effect of 9/11 on New York City into the script. And it's really a backdrop for what happens. And it's also, it's in a way a bit of a love letter to New York City from Spike Lee. And a bit of a way to say we're still here, and all of this city is made up of all of these people, and we're still going to be here no matter what. There's a scene in one of the apartments that looks straight down on Ground Zero, and I think that was probably important for him. Like, you see when you first see the wide shot of New York City from across the bay, you see the lights from where the Twin Towers were, where they used to be there, and then in one of the characters' apartments, you see Ground Zero. And I think it was important for him to establish that, because New York was never the same after that.
Right.
But there's all of the, but it's filled with all of these different kinds of people. So anyways, 25th Hour is about Ed Norton's character, who, you know, is a drug dealer, ends up getting arrested and needs to go to prison. And it's basically his last 24, 25 hours of his life outside before he needs to go report to prison. Rosario Dawson plays love interest, which she was really good in. Barry Pepper plays one of Ed Norton's high school friends, and Philip Seymour Hoffman,
yes,
who is, it's a very quiet role for him, but really good.
It's great.
I mean, it's one of his character roles that is quiet, but well done and memorable. I mean, he always did that awkward, quiet guy really good.
Yeah.
yeah. But, you know, Brian Cox plays Ed Norton's father, typical Irish guy from New York. He owns a bar, you know, and his son got involved with drugs, and this is how everything ended up. And you get that vibe, you know, from the bar, you get the firefighter vibe, which is so New York. And from that to Barry Pepper's character is a stock exchange a guy, so you get this Wall Street vibe. It's just full of all of that kind of thing. And cinematography is great, storyline's great. He does the typical, the very classic now, in my opinion, Spike Lee floating dolly shot.
Yes.
Which I think, you know, as I was doing some research, people kind of give him a hard time for and say, you know, oh, he has to do it. And the truth is, I think, you know, he made that his own, and sure, he's going to do it in almost every project he does. And I think, sure, why not? Because it works. Because when he does use it, it creates that moment that he wants, that magic moment.
His signature style. Right.
And it's a magical moment when, you know, he's doing it in this one, is when, you know, the last night of freedom is in this bar, and Ed Norton comes in, and there's that shot there. And then in his other movies, he does it in very pivotal moments. And so, anyways, it's deserved, and I think it's a good thing, not a negative for him.
Yeah. And this is an interesting movie because this was an example of Spike Lee working for a major studio.
Yeah.
It was a Disney film with a big budget, and it wasn't even a script that he wrote.
Right. It was from a
book. Because usually he writes his films. And yet he still made it feel very personal.
Yeah.
And it feels like a Spike Lee film.
Yeah. It definitely feels it from the mirror monologue that Edward Norton does to the shots and the depth of characters, like that. We were talking earlier how Spike Lee has this sense of not otherworldliness of his scripts, where there's always a slice of magic or something different. You know, like in Malcolm X, he has the narrator, which I think is kind of takes you out of the moment, but purposefully to sets a scene. And 25th Hour, it's like, sure, you're portraying this guy who's a drug dealer, but there's other sense of reality where you don't know what happens at the end. You're not sure. Does he go to prison? Does he not go to prison? Does he go and live this life of where he dreams of being a great family man? And he does that in other films as well.
Yeah, and I think Spike Lee films usually have a moment. And I think the moment in 25th Hour is the famous FU New York speech by Ed Norton.
Right.
Which is incredible, profane, but it's something that Disney was not comfortable with.
Right.
But Spike Lee insisted it's got to be in there. And that's the moment that really makes the film.
Right.
Because it's got the anger and the frustration. Yeah. And
when he's angry at New York for the typical reasons why a New Yorker would be angry at different, like, races, genders, ethnicities. But in the end, it wraps up to but I still make my own choices. And I'm still this man who I'm this, all of the city may be making me angry, but it's still my choice to be here.
Yes.
And love this city.
Yeah. And Do the Right Thing. A lot of people I remember at the time complained when Spike Lee's character throws the trash can through the window at the end of the film, because at that point he becomes an angry character rather than the good guy.
Right.
But it's totally necessary and integral to the plot. And that's the moment that I would guess that a studio would say, oh, don't do that.
Right.
But he did it.
Right. Yeah. And he's, he's so good at that. Yeah. He's good at presenting the flawed person, but having redeemable characteristics and being human, basically. And he does that across all of his movies. I mean, to be able to make Malcolm X a human that we know and understand historically, but also understand emotionally, is pretty awesome. And he does that in almost every one of his films.
Yes, definitely. And also, so I guess we should talk a little bit about his documentary work, because I think a lot of people know him as a narrative filmmaker, but he makes some amazing documentaries, starting in 97 with Four Little Girls.
That's right. Four Little Girls is about a church in Birmingham, Alabama, that was bombed by racists, by terrorists, and four little girls died in it. It was the moment in America where a lot of Caucasian people said, I can't believe that happened. A little bit like Emmett Till, the death of Emmett Till, where it was really startling us awake and aware of what's going on. And to have a church be bombed and for four children to die made the rest of America, Birmingham, Alabama, MLK called it the most segregated city in America at one point. And so it was where things came to a head and to a boiling point. And at that point, Americans said, we've got to change things. We can't allow this kind of hatred and segregation to continue. And so Spike Lee does the documentary. It's a really great documentary from 1997. It was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. And Spike Lee's style is interesting in documentaries. It's not quite as in your face, I don't feel like, as a lot of his other films. Most of his films, he's really putting things in your face to make you question stuff. He does that with Four Little Girls, but just based on on what's there, on the fact that it was a bombing, he puts that in your face, and that four children died. But his style is really kind of a classic documentary style. The one thing that really stands out as I watch a lot of his documentaries, or as I've watched his documentaries, is when he's talking to these people who were in Birmingham at the time. They have a respect for this filmmaker that reaches beyond just the respect of a filmmaker talking to them. They know that they're speaking to Spike Lee, somebody who is culturally and historically significant to them. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I watched a really great documentary that just came out this year called Two Fists Up. And it's about the University of Missouri and these three women who started the Black Lives Matter movement there, because there was so much racism going on at the University of Missouri. They felt like they didn't have the same benefits that other students had. And so they started demanding that things change. The president of the university, Tim Wolf, did nothing in response to them asking for change. And so then they started a hunger strike. One student started a hunger strike, and it's all portrayed by Spike Lee. And he talks to all the participants, and you can tell these students love the fact that Spike Lee is talking to them. It matters. And he uses his voice. You don't generally hear his questions, but every once in a while you hear him ask the question, and you see the admiration with which these people speak to Spike Lee. And I really think that that's his real contribution, in addition to the fact that he's shining a spotlight on things that maybe wouldn't get a spotlight. What happens in the University of Missouri after the hunger strike starts, after about 4 days, the football players on the football team walk out. They boycott. They're not going to play their next game against BYU. And now, finally, that is what gets national attention. It's the fact that all this money is going to be lost, and that these football players are saying, and even when you read reviews of this documentary, it's an hour-long documentary he did for ESPN, even when you read reviews of it, they talk about the football players quitting, not about the three young women who started the Black Lives Matter, not about the president of the student body who had racial slurs flung at him and nothing was done about it, not about the young man who started the hunger strike, but football players decided this mattered. And so, and that was only 2 hours away from Ferguson. And so it's a really, really great documentary that Spike Lee created, just came out this year. You can find it, though. The full director's cut is available online for free to watch if you look around for it. It's really easy to find. It's an excellent documentary. It screened at the Tribeca Film Fest earlier this year, and I recommend it really highly. And the other one I want to bring up is another ESPN documentary, the 30 for 30 Winning Time, Reggie Miller versus the New York Knicks. And it's a really great documentary that Spike Lee is in. He didn't make this one, but he appears in it. And it shows you the character Spike Lee is and who he is and how much fun he can be. You can understand where all the humor in his movies comes from, because the guy's a funny, funny man. He's a very funny person. Those commercials that he made for Nike were very funny. They were cultural phenomenons because they were so funny. And he starts in the documentary Winning Time. Reggie Miller is up against the New York Knicks all the time, and it's New York versus Middle America, Indiana Pacers, Reggie Miller versus Patrick Ewing and the New York Knicks. And Spike Lee's there in the front row. And during playoff games, Spike Lee starts talking trash to Reggie Miller, who's one of the all-time great trash talkers in the NBA. Really hilarious himself. His sense of timing, I think Barack Obama borrows from it. borrows from Reggie Miller's sense of timing a little bit.
Yeah.
Reggie Miller's so great. And so the two are trading barbs from courtside, and Reggie Miller staring Spike Lee down, and the documentary is so great, and it's so funny to hear the two of them talk about each other. And Spike Lee's, you know, Reggie Miller's sister is Cheryl Miller, one of the great female basketball players of all time. She's also in the documentary. And so Spike Lee, he's like, oh no, it wasn't me who was saying Cheryl. It was all those other people around me that were doing it. I would never do that. And he's obviously tongue in cheek, and he's joking. And what happens is really fun, because I grew up in Indiana and I remember those playoff series. And Spike Lee was like public enemy number one in Indiana. And it's almost, when you look at it now, I'm embarrassed. But I didn't hate Spike Lee. I loved Spike Lee. But Indiana just saw him as the epitome. Yeah. It was even more, he was bigger than the Knicks at the time because of the way he started fighting with Reggie Miller.
Well, but he loved it, though.
He loved it. He loved it. And honestly, Reggie Miller loved it. And Reggie Miller went off. Reggie Miller had some of the most memorable moments in the NBA, in the entire NBA, where he scores like 9 points in 7 seconds because Spike Lee's harassing him, you know, and he just goes off. And it really is a real fun back and forth. And the documentary is so much fun. Those 30 for 30s are really, there are a lot of really great documentaries in that series. But Winning Time is certainly one of my favorites, and it makes me laugh. And my wife likes basketball, and she watches that one. She's watched it with me, and she just gets a huge kick out of it. If you like seeing Spike Lee and just hearing what he has to say, that Winning Time is such a great documentary to watch.
Yeah, and he makes a lot of documentaries. Like, he cranks them out pretty quickly. Earlier this year, he made a Michael Jackson documentary, which I saw was pretty good, called Michael Jackson from Motown to Off the Wall. And he also directed Michael Jackson music videos and Prince music videos. I mean, he's someone who never really rest on his laurels and just sticks
working
to one thing.
He's always working.
He's working, you know.
Well, when the levee broke, too.
The levee broke, his Hurricane Katrina documentary was amazing. And he's often referred to his style in general as freestyle, because it's not documentary or narrative. Sometimes it's a traditional documentary, sometimes, but usually it's blending the two. Because I think he's so rooted in the world around him that it always seeps into his narratives.
Oh, yeah. He's brilliant at combining his environment with his story.
Right.
And he does it so well. I mean, one of his sleepers is Crooklyn, and I love Crooklyn. It's a family movie from the 60s. Mm-hmm. And Delroy Lindo is in it, and I can't remember, a lot of young actors, but it's a great story. Then you have Summer of Sam. You know, you have all of these Spike, you know, the one surprising, which I did not know, that he directed the American version of Old Boy, which I have yet to watch.
Oh.
But I thought that was such an interesting directing decision. So I haven't watched it, so I can't say anything about it, but I have seen the original. So I'm excited to watch that. So there's lots of things from wherever you're coming from to watch of Spike Lee's. It's he does have a lot of that in your face, but then he has a lot of other things that are kind of subtle.
He's very unpredictable.
Like Brooklyn and stuff like that.
Well, and Mo' Better Blues is really a subdued Spike Lee movie.
Yeah.
It's really great. His dad did the score for it. His dad is a jazz musician, and they grew up in New York. Spike Lee grew up in New York. His sister is in Mo' Better Blues. It's a really personal film, and it really comes across that way. Really sweetly done. I also really like 1996 Get on the Bus.
Yeah.
I watched that again. Great. That's a really great film. It's an ensemble cast. Mm-hmm. Andre Brower is in it. Ossie Davis is in it in one of his last roles. Ossie Davis was in also a couple other Spike Lee movies, including Do the Right Thing very famously.
Yeah. And I think Jungle Fever gets a bad rap. I think that's a really good film.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
And I think it has to do with the Stevie Wonder song. That's my theory. I have a conspiracy theory about it. I think people don't like that song, so they don't like the film.
I like that song.
I think the film is great.
I like Jungle Fever. It was good.
Well, and finally, in 2015, he came out with Chirac.
Yes.
Which is a really fascinating film. I saw an interview with him on Face the Nation where he's talking about Chirac. It's a play on words. It's Chicago saying that it's so dangerous. And in fact, at one point, it was more dangerous to be in, for some people in Chicago, than it would be to be in Iraq. As Spike Lee points out, though, it's Southwest Chicago, because if you go to downtown Chicago, I went there last October. It's amazing. It's an amazing place. And you would never know that there was any violence around at all, which is really interesting and a really sad commentary on American life right now. But Spike Lee says, you know, everybody should see this because we have a real, it's understating it, saying that we have a gun problem. But he says it's a sickness, right? Mm-hmm. That we have a sickness in this country that has to do with guns. And Chirac really is a thoughtful meditation about that sickness.
Yeah, I felt like it was almost a return to form, almost to the Do the Right Thing, and that it's a very entertaining narrative. And School Days that tackles very serious topics.
Oh, I laughed at it so much.
And it's based on the Aristophanes play, Lysistrata.
Yeah.
The women band together to withhold sex from the men to get them to stop enacting violence. And that's a great hook. And, you know, Sam Jackson is in it as sort of the Greek chorus, wearing these amazing clothes.
Oh, yeah.
Sam Jackson just kind of rules that movie, I think.
He's the highlight for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Cusack's got a really great eulogy that he gives that is really interestingly edited and makes it a really powerful speech. I found Chirac to be heartbreaking at times, hilarious at turns. Really a great film. Really a great Spike Lee film.
Yeah, Angela Bassett. There's a whole cast of great female actresses.
Yeah, that's right.
Nick Cannon does great. I wonder often why he hosts America's Got Talent when he can actually act, but that's another time.
Yeah. So I think before we wrap up, I would like to just maybe put it out to the two of you, the whole idea of a Spike Lee joint. So he calls his film Spike Lee Joints rather than Spike Lee Films. So how would you define a Spike Lee joint? And why do you think he calls it a joint versus a Spike Lee film?
Go ahead.
I don't know what he said about it, but I feel like Lee joint is something that is indelible to him. Like, you can tell he's put his touch on it no matter what it is. And so I think, I mean, I can tell a Spike Lee film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just from the floating dolly shot either, but it's, you know, so I think it makes it unique. And he's an auteur, but he's an auteur in a unselfish way, in my opinion. Like, he wants this to be his, but also reflect society as a whole. Because I think in the end, he does aspire to make things better, to make people learn something at the end of his movie. He does that, but it's his stamp of, like, Spike Lee-ness on it, is my opinion of what a Spike Lee joint is.
He wants us to think, certainly.
Yeah, like, he definitely, you know, wants to make a film, but he wants us to be thoughtful about it. Sometimes heavy-handedly, and sometimes not.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, and that's one thing I think that we've talked about a little, is there's a theatrical nature about his films that when you're entering, it's not quite magical realism. It borders on that. It borders on magical realism, where you've just got these these things happening, and bamboozled. It's a TV producer who decides he's really unhappy with his job, so he's going to make this show that couldn't possibly be made about minstrels and people in blackface, and instead it's made. That couldn't really happen in real life, you would tend to think. Women withholding sex worldwide to end violence couldn't really happen, but it makes for an interesting narrative to make you think about what's happening. And so a Spike Lee joint, and I've not heard him really discuss why it's called that, but it's almost like he's saying, I'm inviting you into my world, into my theater, and I'm going to control the world now, and it's going to get you to think about these bigger issues because of the way we do it. And a lot of his movies, Chirac obviously was a play originally, but a lot of his movies could be plays. Get on the Bus, I could see that as on a stage. Summer of Sam, I could see that as a stage production. Do the Right Thing, certainly. I don't know if it's been on Broadway, if they've ever done that.
It feels like a play.
It totally feels like a play. Yes. And so that's what I think for me when I go and watch a Spike Lee movie. I know I'm going to see something that maybe borders on unreal, borders on magical, because that's what theater kind of does, is magic for us, right? And so I feel like that's probably what he's talking about.
Yeah, and I think calling it a joint actually signals you as the viewer that this is going to be something different.
Yeah.
And I think that's, to me, the most important thing, because it puts you in a different frame of mind when you're going into it. So you're accepting of the musical interludes and the people talking directly to the camera and breaking the fourth wall. All those kind of theatrical elements that he inserts into the film, you're sort of primed because you know this is a joint and not a film. And it's his own specific definition of what a film is. And I think that's what a good auteur does. They define film for themselves.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. And Spike Lee is one of the best that's out there doing it. One thing that in one of the interviews, he mentioned the movie A Face in the Crowd, starring Andy Griffith, directed by Elia Kazan, that made me go back and look at that. And that movie, too, has that theatrical nature where, were it not for the current presidential cycle that's going on, I would think it could never happen, where it's something that it's about a guy who is in jail and he gets on the radio, and because he's just so charismatic and he can tell stories, he starts getting involved in local politics and moves on to a broader thing. And he's really mean and very manipulative. He's very conniving, and he knows that he doesn't like his audience even at all. He's very contemptuous of it. It's an amazing role by Andy Griffith. But I see that could really influence Spike Lee, because it is something that theoretically it's a moment that couldn't really happen, but it's done to get you to think about the nature of television manipulation. In the movie A Face in the Crowd, they talk about a laugh track, and it's only laugh tracks have only been around at that point in America for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about how it's used, the laugh track, to manipulate. He's going to manipulate people into doing what he wants by adding a laugh track to it.
Right.
And it's really interesting. And
yeah, it's a great film.
It's unnerving to watch it now, but it reminds me of a lot of Spike Lee's movies. It was interesting when he mentioned it.
Yeah. And Spike Lee's all about, I think, hyper-reality.
Hyper-reality. Absolutely.
I mean, that's what it is. And some people refer to that as heavy-handed, but it's satire.
Right.
It's
they miss that part. They miss that it's satire. It's like lost on them.
And satire can be really outrageous and heavy, like a Jonathan Swiftian kind of satire.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's hard for people to suss out when something's a satire.
Or a fable, right?
Or
fables,
fable.
Too, where you've got these animals talking and stuff.
Right.
But it's done to show you something bigger. And that's what Spike Lee's doing, like with Chirac. He wants you to think about the fact that we've got a gun issue in America, a sickness in America. Or in Bamboozled, where he's really trying to get you to rethink. Look at television is manipulating you, and they're using these awful stereotypes to do it. And here I'm going to go to the utmost degree to try to show you.
Bamboozled is so outrageous.
It is. It's outrageous.
So outrageous. But it makes a point.
Right.
And you get the point.
But is that the thing? Is that people have a hard time with, like, it's in your face. Like,
yes.
It's so satirical, yet true.
Right.
It's in your face and they can't deal with it.
Well, sometimes you have to throw the trash can through the window rather than tickle people with a feather. And I think that's what he does so well.
Yes.
As Gwendolyn Brooks, the great poet, said from Chicago, she has a poem, Boy Breaking Glass, and the boy in it says, I'll make something, if not a great work of art, a desecration. And because that's the language he has at his disposal.
Yep.
He doesn't have a way to make a great piece of art and have it shown in a theater or shown in a great studio. So instead, or in a gallery, instead, he's going to make something that's his own, and it's a desecration. And so I think that that's part of the throwing the trash can through the window.
Right. And it keeps us talking. So that's important. Well, thanks, Rusty and Heather. This is great. Spike Lee, I would encourage everyone to watch every Spike Lee film, even the ones that you don't like. There's something in them to pull out.
Well, in his first six films, that's a run of six amazing films to start a career with.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, he's incredible. He's one of the best. So thanks, Rusty and Heather.
Thank you.
Jeff.
Yeah. So next week, next time on the Mini Rules of Film Club, we're going to be looking at the French New Wave. Some of the greats, Godard, Truffaut, etc., which leads us to rule number 89 of the Mini Rules of Film Club, which is if it happened early on and happened ahead of the curve, it was probably French. So we'll see about that next week. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.